Hey, it's Shauna Meyerson with Yoga Athletica in Los Angeles, California. I'm here today with Rabbi David Wolpe to dissect the social phenomenon of anti-Semitic hate, particularly in Gen Z, and its implications for both the present and the future of the West. Let me be clear. I am not here to weaponize anti-Semitism or to play victim. Jews are not and have never been victims. We are survivors who have endured the most horrific atrocities of the modern era, risen from the ashes over and over again throughout history, and will continue to do so for all time. The normalization of anti-Semitic hate in America and across the globe goes against all moral standards of Judaism, of yoga, and quite frankly, of humanity. I think we all got a little bit complacent about the state of anti-Semitism in this world, and 10/7 was a huge wake-up call. I personally believe that this descent into depravity and a complete lack of moral clarity will go down in history like Nazi Germany as a confounding social phenomenon, almost impossible to explain. That being said, I'm particularly excited to be having this conversation with Rabbi Wolpe because of his unique facility for unflappable diplomacy that I obviously lack, objectivity, open-mindedness, and optimism. He also happens to be incredibly brilliant and funny and wise and clever, extraordinarily articulate and relatable. He knows that he's flashing it infinitely, entertaining and intriguing. Now, the last time that I was lucky enough to have a discussion with Rabbi Wolpe, I memorized his bio, but it's gotten too long for me to really memorize. So I'm going to go ahead and read the whole thing because, guys, this is a guy worth knowing. I know you love this part. Okay, here we go. Rabbi Wolpe was named the most influential rabbi in America by Newsweek, and one of the 50 most influential Jews in the world by the Jerusalem Post, and twice named one of the 500 most influential people in Los Angeles by the Los Angeles Business Journal. David Wolpe is the Max Webb Emeritus Rabbi of Sinai Temple. He serves as the ADL's inaugural rabbinic fellow and a scholar in residence at the Maimonides Fund. Rabbi Wolpe has taught at Harvard, the Jewish Theological Seminary, the American Jewish University, Hunter College, and UCLA. Rabbi Wolpe has published widely, including in the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Washington Post, Time, Newsweek, and The Atlantic. He's been featured on the Today Show, Face the Nation, ABC This Morning, and CBS This Morning, as well as series on PBS, A&E, History Channel and Discovery Channel, and has engaged in widely watched public debates with Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, Steven Pinker, and many others about religion and its place in the world. Rabbi, this is very long. This is
I
how
know.
curious you are. You're getting bored with your own bio. Rabbi Wolpe is the author of 8 books, including the national bestseller, Making Loss Matter, Creating Meaning in Difficult Times. His latest is titled David, the Divided Heart. It was a finalist for the National Jewish Book Awards and has been optioned for a movie by Warner Brothers. Okay.
Done.
Fun fact about me, happens to be my birthday today. So even though this is a totally random date that you picked for this discussion, it is a tremendous gift to me. So thank you so much.
I'm so honored to be doing it on your birthday. Happy birthday.
Thank you. Okay, so let's get serious. I'd like to start out honestly with something that I think that sometimes things are so basic in concept that people overlook what they actually mean. So can we start by defining anti-Semitism? We have the IHRA definition, which is the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance one, which is sort of like lengthy and hard to really articulate, but in over 45 countries have adopted it, including the USA. But how would you personally define anti-Semitism?
Thank you, and thanks for this chance. to be with you again. Last time was in person. It's nice to do it virtually, in person, in any way we can. I would start by reminding people that when we say anti-Semitism, sometimes people will say, oh, well, that can't refer to Jews alone because that aren't Arab Semites. Actually, Semitic is a family of languages, not really a people, but that's irrelevant. Anti-Semitism is a term that was coined in the late 1800s by a man named Wilhelm Marr to make hatred of Jews sound more scientific than just saying Jew hatred. So anti-Semitism is a word that literally was conjured by a hater of Jews to mean hatred of Jews. And that's why we use that word, even though it causes a lot of confusion. I would define it as hatred of Jews, of the Jewish people, of the state they created, of usually it takes the form of some kind of conspiracy theory. Jews run the banks, run the world, run Hollywood, run something. And it always seems to have this weird combination of both, I wouldn't say admiration, but of thinking of Jews as both superhuman and subhuman at the same time. They're like the vermin who control the world. And so it's a weird hatred in some sense. And almost always, whatever it is that people are bothered about or dislike, somehow the Jews are implicated. So they're communists when people hate communism, and they're capitalists when people hate capitalism. And they're stateless and wandering when people hate them for being stateless and wandering, and they have a state and they're too tough in defending it when they have a state. It doesn't matter what it is that you dislike, somehow you will find that the Jews are the ones who did it. And that ought to, in and of itself, give people some suspicion that it's about something more than your objective evaluation of circumstances. It's about some kind of deep hatred of Jews.
Sure. And though that definition is fairly modern, at least as Jews, we know, I don't know if the whole world knows. I mean, anti-Semitism really is the world's oldest hatred. Yeah. Again, there was a certain complacency that felt like it sort of went away. We knew the undercurrent was always there, but this has been since basically the beginning of recorded history. And I do want to just make one quick note about your concept of Semitism as being a form of languages. A lot of people will equate anti-Semitism with Islamophobia. Now, I want to make two points here. One is more than 50% of all hate crime in this nation is against the Jews. That's more than every other group combined. Yeah. But the other thing I want to say, which is just simply about like the actual nomenclature, anti means against, Semitism, again, it's meant to mean Jews regardless of what like the broader concept of Semitism is. But if you break down the word Islamophobia, phobia does not mean hatred of, it means fear of. And it's also not Muslim phobia or anti-Muslim, it's Islam, which is the radical branch of the Muslim religion, I guess would be the best way to say it. Radical or fundamentalist. So there's really no equating anti-Semitism with Islamophobia. So I do want to put that out there, and it looks like you might have something to add to that.
Well, there's an asymmetry in these evaluations in the sense that everybody knows that, as you said, first of all, like there isn't a synagogue that doesn't have security. And if they don't have security, they want security. Very few churches and mosques in America require security. And it's not as though there isn't hatred of Muslims. There are people who hate Muslims, absolutely. And there are people who committed crimes against Muslims. But as an organized religion, the danger of, for example, insulting Moses or writing a novel that is negative about Jesus is that people might attack you on Twitter. But if you do the same about Muhammad, you're taking your life into your hands. And so there's also an asymmetry in the response to hostility towards these religions that suggests that that Islam, and I think many Muslims recognize this, have, at least in part of the Islamic world, a civilizational problem that they need to address in order to be able to defend Islam the way other religions defend themselves, which is rhetorically and not with arms.
Yeah, it's interesting because what I would on one hand consider to be sort of this post 9/11 phenomenon of Muslim philo-Muslimism, I don't know what to call it, this fascination with Islam is with the, sorry, with Muslim world is almost synonymous in a way or an extension of Islamophobia, because I believe that it's out of fear of what Islam could do to me that people have become very, very, very obsessively obsequious to a point to sort of Muslim culture, the Arab world, and maybe even as a precursor to this very strange alignment of the far left with terrorists.
I don't know what the psychological factors are in people's allegiances, but I certainly agree that there is a strange sense of cultural connection. I mean, I understand someone who says, I think what Israel is doing in Gaza is terrible. I understand that. And that's an argument that is absolutely worth having. Don't understand someone who says, I'm pro Hamas, because Hamas is a fanatical terror organization that makes no bones about who it is and what it wants. It's not as though it's hiding its aims. And so if you ally yourself with that kind of organization, what are you saying about your values? And I think that there is a strong anti-Western prejudice in general now, and the Jews have sort of are the stand-in for the West. So when the Houthi flag says, for example, death to America, death to Israel, death to Jews, it's showing you that they think of that all as sort of one package, or we're the big Satan and the little Satan, which is how Iran puts it. So there is a degree to which sympathy for human beings is completely understandable and admirable, but sympathy for an ideology that is noxious and hateful isn't.
Yeah, especially as a result of Jews, Israelis, I mean, obviously it wasn't just Jews, let's say Israelis, citizens of the Jewish state, being the victims of the most horrifying massacre of the modern day. I think that what has shocked most of us the most is not that anti-Semitism, which will cycle around every few generations, has come back, but the circumstances and the glee that people have had in bringing this back to the mainstream.
Yeah, the almost instantaneous lack of sympathy for Jewish victims was, I have to say, I think for most of us, a shock to our system. It's like, had you said to me, you know, they're going to, I mean, look, when I left last year for Harvard, people said, you know, how are you going to do on that campus? You know, they're not sympathetic to Israel on that campus. And I said, that's not why I'm going there. If somebody asks me, or if the issue comes up, obviously everybody knows where I stand, and that will, but that isn't like what I'm intending to make my year about. I'm not going there as an Israel advocate. I'm going to teach, I'm going to write a book, and we'll see what happens. Then October 7th happened. And I was, and I, as I said, I went there knowing that there wasn't tremendous sympathy for Israel among many. There are some, obviously, but among many on the campus. But the jubilation and the lack of sympathy for human victims, for sexual violence, for children who were killed, on and on, was truly just shocking, Jewishly and just humanly. And I don't think I will ever forget the feelings that I had those first days when I just thought, what the hell is going on?
Yeah, you stepped into the moment, and you know, it. I, if you believe in divine providence, I think that you were sent there.
So, do you know how many people sent me the verse from Esther that said, "What? Maybe it was just for this moment that you were elevated." In that case, it was to the kingship, to the queenship, actually. But the same thing is like maybe just for this moment you were sent to Harvard, and I really I did I have to say I did feel when people say, well, how was your year? The answer, the honest answer is, yeah, as difficult as it was, it was infinitely more meaningful than if I had sequestered myself in a library and written a book. So do I regret that I was there this year? No, I'm glad that that was the year I was there. I really am.
Yeah, it's funny. I totally off topic, and I'm only going to say this in one sentence, is the same way I feel about lockdown. Living alone, it was such an introspective time for me. I would say it was the most powerful, probably year I've ever lived. So one of the things I do want to talk about, I'm very active in APAC because of you. You inspired me. And I have to say that after going to innumerable policy conferences, the one thing that stands out more than anything in all the years, all the plenaries, all the breakout sessions, was the time when you and Frank Luntz asked each other five difficult questions. And the one that I remember and that I've carried with me was that he said, and I might be wording this incorrectly, but it was pretty on target, how has Judaism let you down? Now, I remember your answer. Do you remember your answer?
No, what did I say?
Okay, because it's listening to some of your newer stuff, it shifted just a little bit. But what you said, and I was amazed how you guys just off the cuff, and apparently you guys hadn't even told each other what the questions
were. No, I had no idea.
Okay, so prepare to be amazed by your own answer. What you said is that the way that that Judaism has sort of let you down is that we don't educate our kids beyond the bar bat mitzvah, wherein Christians, like, Bible study is like something that they do into their 90s. Now, as an addendum, I know that you've said sort of very similarly, now we're letting them down maybe not even letting them down, that we're not giving them a fair shot by not taking them to Israel often enough. And both of it comes back to what we offer our children as family, as parents, grandparents, et cetera, versus what they're getting in school.
Right.
Ring a bell?
No, absolutely. The thing is that Judaism is countercultural. It's like if you live in America, the default is to be nothing or to be a sort of light variety of Christian. And Judaism takes a lot of education, a lot of time, and a lot of thought. And so if you're going to raise a child to be a Jewish child, it requires effort and time. And Judaism sort of demands that, because the truth is what you get at 13, just imagine if you're understanding of politics or of mathematics or of history stopped at 13. And so you get all these 50, 60 year olds who are walking around with a 13 year old understanding of Judaism. And of course it's juvenile because it's never grown up. And we saw this, among other things, we did see this after October 7th, which is, I know where you're going with the question, because all of a sudden people said, oh my God, there's something here that I didn't understand and I didn't really appreciate. And of course, as I think this conversation illustrates, that also presents an opportunity to say to people, yes, well, now you understand that this is a much deeper and more complex and sometimes more scary and fraught thing than you ever imagined. And so I hope that you will actually now find out what we're really talking about when we say Judaism. It's not all bar mitzvah parties.
Yes, absolutely. And on that same note, I do want to, so the big discussion obviously right now is about college campuses, particularly elite campuses and particularly Ivy League campuses. Right. But I think that as with all issues in the age of social media, we need to stop thinking top down and start thinking bottom up, which is, I hate to say, what they're doing in Gaza, which is indoctrinating preschoolers already to hate Israel, to kill Jews. Hold on, just before anybody assumes where I'm going with this, I'm not going there, but that these children, it starts at an early age. So by the time they get to, let's say, college age, like, they know full well what their mission is in life. Now, in no way am I saying that we should in a million years indoctrinate our children with that kind of, believe me, I can see people watching this going, oh, she wants them to all grow up to be, you know, no. So, but here's the thing, is that when I was a kid, right, and I grew up in sort of, let's say, the shadow of the Holocaust, I'm 53 today, and the conversation that always came to me, both at home and in school, was, as Jews, we cannot afford to hate. That's how I grew up. I grew up in a Jewish day school, and I didn't even know there was a conflict in the Middle East. I literally did not know that there was a conflict over the land of Israel. So because I grew up with this very positive association to Judaism, to Israel, and also my responsibility as a Jewish child growing up into whatever, a Jewish woman, it made it very easy for me at this age to speak up, speak out, because I am 100% confident in what I know and understanding the background, the context, which has become such a bad word now, and I hate even saying it, but that kids today are not being brought up with that. They're afraid to speak up because why would they? They don't even know the fact. They don't even know, a lot of them, like you say, what it means to be Jewish. Our children are moving further and further from all religion. And so how do we bring them back to the point where, as Jews and every single Jew, we need to come together at this time to defend our future?
So there's a lot to unpack in what you said, and I want to start out where you started, which is when we tell people that there are people who are who are brought up to hate Jews, they might not believe us. So I want to quote to you something that Ayan Hirsi Ali said, who grew up in Somalia. She said, growing up in Somalia, which is a Muslim country, she said, and a pretty fundamentalist Muslim country, she said, growing up in Somalia, I didn't know any Jews. I didn't even know anyone who knew any Jews,
right?
But I knew that Jews were evil.
Right.
Now, here's someone whose world was not at all touched by Jews. And right. Yet the education was Jews are evil. That really does exist in parts of the world where children are not only growing up, but then they're going to college in America. And part right. of what we saw in this past year, it's not only about funding from the Middle East, and it's not only about progressive ideology, it's also about literal students. I sat with three students from Pakistan. None of them said it explicitly, but I know what their education was in Pakistan. I know it in part because years ago, and I know this is a little bit of a tangent, but I think it's worthwhile. Years ago, I had a Pakistani come as part of a scholarship group to services at Sinai Temple. And after the service, he came up to me and he goes, you know what? I can't believe what I just saw. This is not at all what they tell us Jews and Judaism are like in Pakistan. And I said, do me a favor. He said, what? I said, when you go home, tell people that. And he laughed and he said, nobody will believe me.
Right.
And I thought, this is what Jews face. And right. this is in part what has triggered this anger on college campuses, are people who were brought up to be perfectly willing to believe that if there is evil, Jews must be behind it. And the flip side of that is, as you said, that here in America, we bring Jews up to be in ignorance both of their heritage and also to a great extent in ignorance of how other people view their heritage. And so part of the, of the mandate of October 7th is to try to reverse both of those. That is to make Jews more aware of what it is to be Jewish and to make the world more aware of how people view Judaism in many places in the world that pose a considerable civilizational threat, if not in arms, then in culture, to the things that I think most of us hold dear.
I agree. And unfortunately, the only, it's not even a disagreement. The only thing I would like to add to that is that honestly, the kids who are going to Harvard and in all the schools that are harboring this anti-Semitic indoctrination, yes, many of them are coming from countries like Pakistan, like Somalia, where it's all they know. But sadly enough, a lot of them are actually coming from America. The new ethnic studies models that have been coming out have been indoctrinating kids with either blatant or latent anti-Semitism, definitely anti-Israel. And it does not help that most of these kids go home to white Jewish parents who they're also being taught to disrespect. And so as much as I would love the low-hanging fruit of, you know, these people who just don't know any better because they've been told their whole lives that Jews are bad, unfortunately and very frighteningly, it's also coming from America. And though so much of the discussion these days, again, is about higher ed, I'm super worried about Gen Z, what they are learning in school as early as preschool, kindergarten, first grade, and carrying through for 12 years of education before they even get to college.
So it's a complicated issue because there are several levels to the shift in education and ideology that's happened throughout the Western world, but certainly in America. But you see it, as you know, in England, in France, in Germany, in Switzerland, in Sweden. I mean, it's not obviously only America. Although it certainly is America. And one piece of it, the good piece of it, okay, let's for a moment at least focus on the thing that's positive, okay, is that there are disenfranchised voices who now have a voice in public discourse. And that is a really wonderful thing. And that's something to be celebrated. And there is more balance in the appreciation of the difficulties and the tragedies and the crimes and the sins of the history of all of humanity, especially of the West. But that's a separate question. And that too should be absorbed because as a Jewish people, we really do believe that you have to confront what you've done wrong in order to do tshuva. It's had two effects though that are really tragic and lamentable and bad for Jews. One is that sometimes when you believe in something and you get disillusioned, you think that the disillusion is all that matters. And the truth is that it is true that the West, that America was built partly on slavery, but it is also true that the West was the only culture that ended slavery. And if you look at one and not the other, then you think, oh, well, the West is all bad because it had slavery, but it's its own ideas and ideals that undermined slavery in the West, but didn't elsewhere in the world. In fact, there's still are more slaves in absolute numbers in the world now than there ever were in human history. And when you look at the top 10 countries, with the exception of North Korea, all of them, whether in sub-Saharan Africa or elsewhere, Islamic countries, and there's slavery there, and that receives no protests on campus, unsurprisingly. We're talking about Mauritania and Eritrea and all those countries. The second thing that it did was it made it seem that the accomplishment of something was automatically invalid. And so if somebody was successful, they couldn't be successful because of merit, because the whole structure was essentially unfair. They had to be successful because they took advantage of this unfair structure. And that's bad for Jews in two ways. One is that in fact, Jews overcame enormous oppression to be successful, which is not evident to people who were born in 1990. And second is that if you decide that disproportionate achievement is automatically wrong and inauthentic, then the first place you point your finger is at the Jews, because the Jews are vastly disproportionately successful to their numbers and to the opposition that they face. And so weirdly, which is really, it is weird, all these organizations that are in theory about correcting the oppressions of the past totally ignore the oppressions of the past of the Jewish people and try to diminish the possibility of achievement or of merit in the Jewish present, which is one more log to the fire of anti-Semitism. And so you have this really complex and as yet unsolved difficulty that we want to be able to honor and elevate the voices of people who have been oppressed in the past, but not at the expense of enabling people to overcome obstacles and achieve in the present. And unfortunately, we haven't worked out the math of that very well yet.
Right. What do you think is at the core? Like, is it resentment? Is it jealousy? Is it, why the Jews? I mean, we're extremely
successful. At least part of it is, I mean, so there is a sort of difficulty at the core of social policy and human achievement, which is, it's true that if somebody is disadvantaged, and there will always be more and less disadvantage, it's true that if somebody's disadvantaged, it's a lot harder for them to get ahead.
Sure.
But it is also strangely true that if you say to them, the reason you're not getting ahead is because you're disadvantaged, it de-incentivizes them to get ahead. So you have people who will not accept excuses. You started off by saying Jews aren't victims. The Jews would not accept excuses for their own lack of achievement. They wouldn't say, well, look, we've gone through this terrible history, we've been persecuted and so on, so of course we don't do anything. How can you blame us? No, in fact, what we said was that because we have been so persecuted, we have to redouble our efforts to achieve. Mm-hmm. And that is essential, but the structures of victimization de-incentivize people, and yet at the same time, it is true that certain people have really undergone terrible suffering for which they should be acknowledged and helped. And so it's a really difficult calculus how you manage both of those. Like for me, I think that the exclusive emphasis, for example, on race is a mistake, because a kid who grows up in Appalachia and, you know, and loses his parents to the opioid epidemic and doesn't have and has never really been schooled and comes to college, he hasn't been advantaged because he's white. He's, in fact, been tremendously disadvantaged, not because he's white, but just in terms of his life. And he also deserves to be helped. So I think we should have an adversity affirmative action. But these are complicated social problems and policies. And I don't know of any place that has gotten it exactly right. But unfortunately, what we do see again and again and again is that the Jews get the short end of the stick. And when you have DEI programs, so often they don't include Jews, even though we are clearly a minority and have clearly been oppressed.
Sure. Sure. We're 2% of America and 0.02% of world. But people think that we are this big, like super, like 30% of the world. Okay. You're absolutely right. And let me just say the flip side of that is if you're Barack and Michelle's child, you're going to have advantages that, you know, millions and millions of white children are not going to have. So there's a lot of parameters.
I'm really glad you said that, because and yet, weirdly, if you're Barack Obama and you grew up as a black man who didn't have a father, he had to push himself to be the achievement. And then in one generation, you're right, it can flip so that your children are children of tremendous privilege. That's why it's such a complicated calculus, because America enables, America is still, I don't care what anyone says, we still have to, you know, we still have to worry that people, too many people want to come here, not too many people want to leave. This is still a place of incredible, enormous opportunity. But we have our issues. We have our issues.
Sure. Okay, so let me, I do want to sort of focus a little bit more on like the next gen, and let's go back a couple steps, because I do want to get into very specifically some of what you saw at Harvard, particularly because a lot of people are saying, oh, you know, they're kids, they'll grow out of it, they'll this or that. Mm-hmm. They're not just kids, they're actually our next generation of leaders. And we can't rely as our best tactic strategy that hopefully they'll grow out of it. Okay, so I'm concerned because, again, if this were just like SMCC, I would probably be Santa Monica, I'd probably be less concerned than what I saw when I went to the rally at UCLA.
Yes.
And the level of vile hatred mixed with astounding ignorance. I had, so they warned us, they're like, you know, don't engage, don't engage, don't engage. And I'm walking out and there's this chain of people and there's this guy and he's literally yelling, "We love the Jews, Intifada revolution, it's the only solution." And I'm like, what? What do you mean you love the Jews and you want an intifada? And I'm like, do you know what the intifada is? And like, no. I had my camera on him. He wouldn't answer. All these people came and they blocked my camera and the whole bit. And it's like, are these people just so desperate to belong to a movement that they can't even take 5 minutes to say, hey, I'm chanting the slogan, what does it mean? Because you can't love Jews and call for intifada.
No. And you know, I mean, there was this famous article in the Wall Street Journal that asked all these kids who were chanting from the river to the sea, which river and what sea? And they had no idea. The Nile, the Mississippi. We're not sure. Lake Erie. I think it's Lake Erie. It was funny, but it wasn't funny because they're doing enormous damage. And yes, I think, by the way, the first thing you pointed to, we should not underestimate how powerful the desire is to belong. But that shouldn't necessarily make us feel better, because unless something changes, that desire to belong and that community is going to go, as you said, not only through your teens, but through your 20s, your 30s, your 40s, your 50s. And we know how many people express political opinions, not because they've thought about them, but because they don't want to break from their crowd. And so the part of what I walked by the encampments at Harvard many, many, many times, talked to a couple of the people there. And one of the things, what's that?
How did you talk to, like, you just walked up?
They were all there, so I talked to them. Some would talk to me and some wouldn't. Most of them knew who I was. Some of them didn't want to talk to me, but some of them did.
Okay.
And one of the things that I will tell you, which will not surprise you one bit and probably won't surprise your listeners one bit, they were having the time of their lives. They were having the best time. They were like showing everybody at Harvard how powerful they were and what a loud voice they had. And they were all chanting together. And there was a lot of sexual energy in the encampments. I won't say more than that.
Muslims love that. They're very,
you can use your imagination.
Sexual promiscuity.
So it was really a community. It created a community. And that's what people want, especially people who are going to college. They want to create their community. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways you create community is by saying those people over there are terrible. So there was that. Now, I think what you said is exactly right and really important for us to recognize. That doesn't mean that they're going to grow out of it when they're 30 or 40. They might, and some will, but a lot of them may not, and we don't know. And you certainly can't rely on it. So it's the task of those of us who have any kind of public voice to try to consistently educate and also uneducate people who are part of this elite cohort. Now, it is one piece of good news. We should have at least one piece of good news here. We're talking about 50 or 60 colleges, and there are about 4,500 in the United States. So most colleges and universities had no protests, no sit-ins, no encampments, no problem. But the ones that did are elite colleges, and they're very significant. And so we have to take it seriously, even as we understand that for most people, this was not their defining. I mean, for most Americans, this was not their defining moment. For people who were paying attention or who were Jewish or who were on these campuses, it was a defining moment.
Right. So I think, as Sam Harris and others have like pointed out about how everybody having a phone has turned everybody into their own news station, and it's really corrupted the world. And certainly, I think there's a certain amount of showmanship that went into this. And also the communal aspect of being able to rise up against the common enemy, and also in the name of social justice. And so I think that is a very common explanation of what happened. But I can tell you, as somebody who's, you know, heavily into social media, or just anybody who pays attention to, forget about this, what people have said about social media for the past few years is how much it makes young people feel desperately inferior, right? Everybody has a better life, a better body, better grades, better boyfriend, girlfriend. They're better at sports. They're going to a better college. They have the best parents. And so what happens is we have this generation of children who are so desperate, not just for whatever, the attention that they could get by clicking a button, but also to have the ability to be the bully for a change, to be the person who feels superior, wherein they have grown up the last two decades being hammered with inferiority. Right. And I think that it's not just belonging. I think it's like, I know that in the 80s, there was a movie called The Wave that we all watched in Hebrew school. Do you know that movie?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's a true story about, I'm sure you know the story, about this high school teacher in America who was trying to teach Nazi Germany to his kids.
Was this the paper clips?
No.
Oh, okay.
I don't think so. The way that I remember it, basically, he's like, one day because they couldn't understand how could this have happened, Nazi Germany. And he's like, you know what? Today, everyone with blue eyes gets an extra apple.
Right.
And everybody's like, what? And at first, like, people are really bewildered. And then he piles it on until at the very end, he turns them over to their new leader. And it's a big video of Hitler, and they understand what happened. And so it's intoxicating. It's intoxicating to feel better than someone, particularly at a time when people feel so much worse.
I think that that's true, and that is an ever-present danger in the world. It doesn't explain why the hatred of the Jews was the thing that made people cohere and feel better and feel superior.
Except for hasn't it always?
Yes, that is true. One of the things that anti-Semitism has traditionally done is create coalitions, because the Jews are significant enough that hating them makes waves, so to speak, but they're also small enough that they're fairly safe to hate. And it's amazing, at a time when so many groups cannot be spoken of negatively in any way on college campuses, that speaking negatively of Jews for virtually no consequences. I think that will change on many of the campuses now, having gone through what we've gone through, having seen what the consequences are. I think there will be laws and there are already laws and restrictions on a number of campuses. We'll see how this plays out in the weeks ahead. But yes, it does enable you to tie into others in a way that is both intoxicating and, as the word implies, toxic.
Yes. Yes. So one thing about alliances, and I'll point to something that's very obvious to you, but again, not to the world at large, is that when it comes to civil liberties, civil rights, all the way back to, you know, the founding of this nation, is the Jews that have marched with everybody. And there's no irony lost on me that while we're busy marching with Martin Luther King, you know, there is, you know, Students for Justice.
I have to interrupt you here,
yeah,
only to tell you, I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right, but I have to tell you this great story.
Tell me.
So reinforces what you said. So I did a panel with Van Jones.
Okay.
And he was talking about the fact that, you know, he brought together all these Black leaders and he said, the Jews were there for us. We have to be there for them. And he said that he said to these leaders, he said, listen, you think you have white friends. He said, you don't. All your white friends are Jewish. He said, your friend Rachel, she's Jewish. Your friend Jared, right, he's Jewish. And then right, he said, I'll never forget this line. I was sitting next to her. He says, I want you to know that if Jews were purple, Blacks would have no white friends. And I just thought, it's exactly what you're saying. He put it so beautifully. And he said, like, the Jewish community has, in fact, not all Jews, obviously, has in fact been at the forefront of virtually every liberation movement in this country, and for that matter, in Western history. And yet, when the time has come for the allyship that we seek, some people have shown up, as he did, as Van Jones did,
sure,
but so few, it's been dispiriting.
Yeah, I have to say, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Sinai Temple had a huge Black Lives Matter banner that was hung on.
I will correct you.
No, not
Black Lives Matter.
No. What was it?
We had a banner that said, Sinai Temple stands with our African American brothers and sisters against racism.
Okay.
Not the same as endorsing Black Lives Matter. It was about
100% agree.
Issue at the time. Yeah.
Okay. 100% agree. 100% agree. And yet the Black Lives Matter literally, has spelled out that they are against, you fill in the adjectives, Israel. And of course there was the BLM in Chicago that
right,
had the, hang glider thing.
Yeah.
So I know I need to respect your time, but I want to say one thing and then I want to say one more thing, which,
sure.
Okay. So alliances are our natural solution. And I will say that it actually was, if you look at the history of Students for Justice in Palestine, their strategy, they formed alliances for 10 years before doing their big ask, which is, oh, by the way, will you support us in this thing? Great. So the easy low-hanging fruit is, let's do the same thing. Let's form these alliances. But the problem comes back to the question and is precluded by these children's absolute desperation to belong. So how do we find allies who are brave enough to stand essentially alone with Israel?
Well, one of the ways you do it is by thanking the people who do it. I tell that Van Jones story not only because it's a great story, but because I want people to know. And I always tell particularly Jewish audiences, if you see a public figure who stands up for the Jewish people, send them an email. Yes. Try to find out how to thank them, because we're so much better at identifying enemies than we are at embracing friends. And people, yes, don't want to be your friend if you don't thank them for being your friend. So one of the things that I think we need to do is to learn how to just say thank you to the people who do stick their neck out for the Jewish people. And there are such people, there really are. And it's tremendously important. I'm going to be speaking in 2 weeks in West Point. And I'm going to thank, and I'm just going to thank them, you know, because I know how much it meant to Israel that the American forces stood there and said to Iran, if you attack, you're going to have to go through us. And, and that's incredibly important, and they should be thanked.
Sure.
So that matters.
And John Spencer has been one of our most important
allies. Amazing.
And I did an interview with him as well on the podcast. So just an incredible human and with no skin in the game. Of course, you and I have a lot of skin in the game. So you absolutely have to reach out to our allies. In wrapping up, because I know you have to go, I do want to just make one quick just statement for people who don't understand, because Jews are such peaceful people. And it's funny and sad at the same time how people are boxing us in as genocidal baby killers, whatever. And when I'm at Shabbat service at Sinai Temple, I do spend time reading the English as well, because I'm not fluent in Hebrew, and it helps me to really connect. And the number of prayers that are literally just calling for peace. They are just calling for peace. And I'm like, if only these people who think that we are such hate-loving, war-loving, death-loving, whatever it is, loving people, if they could just pick up the siddur, if they could go to one of our rallies, or even go to AIPAC, that people think is this, like, violent, right-wing, war-loving organization. It's not. Even at AIPAC, all we ever talk about is the pathway to peace. It's all we talk about.
I tell people all the time, all you have to do to make peace with Israel is say you want peace.
Exactly.
Egypt said they wanted peace. They have peace. Jordan said they wanted peace. They have peace. The Abraham Accord countries said they wanted peace. They have peace. That's all you have to do. In the absence of doing that, though, I think the Jewish people is tired of laying down and dying. And so we will fight.
Yes.
And we've gotten good at it out of necessity, but it's not, in fact, what we want to do with our time. I mean, there's a reason why Israel is the third or fourth largest creator of software companies in the world, despite the fact that it's like 6 million people, as opposed to India having a billion, or the United States having 350 to 400 million. I mean, we're a blip on the earth, but we are a people that really does want to create something as opposed to battle. And I just pray that someday soon we'll be able to do only one and not, no more of the other.
I 100% pray with you.
As a
closing thought, I'm going to get a little negative here, but then I'll get positive, because we got to end on a high note.
Mm-hmm.
Historically speaking, every civilization that has been consumed by anti-Semitism throughout history has ended up consuming itself. This is not just a Jewish problem. This is a humanity problem.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the negative part. Now I'm going to get into the positive part, because your optimism for the future always inspires me. And of course, the anthem, the national anthem of Israel, is Hatikvah, the hope, because we are a people who are built on hope. We're going through a dark valley right now. I have confidence we're going to emerge. I have my own reasons why I believe that. But for you, where do you see the hope for the future?
I see it in two places. First of all, I know that in Jewish history, things have been much darker than they've been now, much darker. I mean, 100 years ago, we were in a far worse place. 90, 80 years ago, a third of our people was killed. And so I know that we have come through much more difficult moments than we have today. And also, I know that today, to a great extent, we have the resources and the self-determination to be able to fight. And that also has not been true for 2,000 years of Jewish history. And so it is my faith, both in God and in the Jewish people, that enables me to believe that, you know, Be'erev Yalim Bechi U'Baboker Rina, that in the evening there will be weeping, as the psalmist said, but there's joy in the morning.
Beautiful note to end on. And it really, really does sum up the Jewish experience so well. Rabbi Wolpe, do you have any last thoughts or things that I have not addressed that you'd like to bring up before we say goodbye?
Just thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It has been, as always, my greatest honor and privilege. I'm not going to get all like fangirl on you this time. I'm going to just leave it at thank you so much. You always bring just so much wisdom and clarity.
Thank you.
And you are a gift to the Jewish people.
As are you.
Bye, everyone. Thank you so much.